Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have questions about the moral implications of modern biotechnology? Are you maybe unsure about the ethics of a particular medical procedure? Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our topic this hour, issues in bioethics. If you do have such questions, 888-318-7884 is the number. And our guest is one of the clearest, most compelling voices you are going to hear on such issues. Father Tad Paholczyk is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He holds a doctorate in neuroscience from Yale University, among a host of other degrees. Father Tad, thank you very much for being with us here today on Catholic Answers Live.
Well, thanks for having me, Cy. Great to be with you.
Now, Father, I was just thinking today, we have a new nominee for the Supreme Court who is apparently a pro-life person, and judges are more and more ruling on issues of bioethics. And I wondered, for you, is there maybe one thing that you would like all judges to know or to take into consideration when they rule on these kind of cases?
That's a good question. I mean, it's it's connected a little bit to the question of what a proper judicial philosophy should be. And, you know, I'd say in a sense that's a little bit outside my purview. I think one always wants a judge to bring sound human values to any of his decisions that he's making. And these obviously have to provide the proper respect for human life and for other issues that are critical to us as humans, like religious liberty. So I think, you know, there's some very, very basic goods that you would want a judge to be in tune with. And it's surprising that, in fact, there are, you know, a number of judges who don't seem to be when we talk about the life issues, beginning and end of life issues. I mean, I was glad to hear that this new nominee has written a book on assisted suicide. And I thought, you know, that's a very compelling fact to be aware of. I think that he has thought through that issue probably to great depth. And once you do that on either end of the life spectrum, I think there's a good likelihood that, you know, you're going to have a vision of human life that is really a wholesome one, and one that will be very good for the future of the country, and, you know, one that that I hope will find its way in back into more and more of the laws of our great land.
It does, in fact, seem that another vision, a different vision, prevails in many parts of our culture, not just among judges. I don't want to, you know, pick judges out like they're the villains of the piece, but. They're part of the culture as well, and there is a vision kind of in the kind of out there in the culture of the human person that is very dismissive of the value of human life.
Yes, I would agree, and I mean, what I think you're implying as well is that when the culture starts to move in a certain direction, many other components of it, including judges,
right,
and elected officials and others, tend to sort of go where the winds are blowing. And so, you know, to have somebody who has thought these things through in a deeper way and is not swayed easily by those winds, I think is a very, very positive and hopeful sign for the future. I would agree.
888-318-7884 is the number. You're listening to Catholic Answers Live, and Father Tad Paholczyk is our guest this hour. The topic, issues in bioethics. Any issues that you may have, any questions you may have about bioethic or bioethical or medical issues. Maybe there's a procedure. Maybe there's something that's a need in the family to make a decision about a family member's health or those kinds of things. Father Tad is an expert in answering. Well, I think that's the right word, an expert in answering those kinds of questions. And your calls are welcome on those topics, 888-318-7884. 7884. And do you, at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, Father, do you get new questions all the time? Like, oh, there's some new advance, and wow, we've never had to answer that before. I would imagine that that's the case, that as new technologies break and these kinds of things, you go, well, no, haven't heard that one before.
Definitely. That certainly happens. I mean, I can give you a couple examples that have happened, let's say, in the past 2 to 3 years. One of them would be uterus transplants. You know, that wasn't really something that was on the horizon. And now it's something that has been done a number of times, and it raises, you know, a host of questions. So we have gotten requests to, you know, bring some clarity to that. People will use our consultation service. It's probably worth mentioning, you know, to the listenership that we have a free consultation service. If they go to our website, ncbcenter.org, they can type in a particular question that they might have, and one of our ethicists will get back to them, typically in 4 or 5 days, sometimes sooner if they indicate that it's something more urgent. We do about 2,000 free consultations per year. So, you know, that we do run into these questions that are, in a sense, brand new that we weren't anticipating. Another one that's been in the news that you've no doubt heard about just recently is the question of pig-human chimeras, where they take some human stem cells, put them into a developing pig embryo, and then that embryo, as it grows up into a bigger pig, has a few human cells scattered throughout its body. And the idea would be, you know, maybe you could make an entirely human kidney inside the pig. And if that were possible, it's not possible yet to do that at all, not even close. But if that became possible in the future, then you would have a ready source of human organs that could be transplanted to some very, very sick patients who needed it.
But I have to say, Father, when you even mention that, there's something that kind of revolts in me. I don't know. Like, I guess they would call it the yuck factor. Is that something we should listen to, or are we sometimes wrong to have those immediate kind of, I don't know, almost a gross out response? Like, no, they shouldn't do that.
Right. You know, that's some bioethicists have termed that a sense of repugnance.
Yeah.
And the short answer is sometimes it's good to have that, but, you know, other times not. And you need to sometimes scratch the surface a little bit more to get down to whether that repugnance is actually rooted in anything or whether it's just, you know, a kind of emotional reaction. Because, I mean, I can give you a simple example. You know, I think 30 years ago or longer, when we started doing in vitro fertilization and we were creating new humans in glassware, there was that sense of repugnance. People were saying, oh, that's, you know, that's weird. That's not right. You know, you should only come into the world in the marital embrace in your mother's womb. And I think that kind of repugnance is right. That, you know, because when you examine that, it's perfectly clear that we shouldn't be making human life in glassware and then freezing it, you know, in these cryogenic storage containers and discarding those embryos and doing all these other terrible things to them. That's obviously wrong. But you can also have repugnance from other things, maybe, or at least let's say we go back 70 years. Somebody might have had repugnance at the idea of, let's say, a black man and a white woman getting married. And, you know, you'd have to say, well, there isn't any objective reason to have a repugnance there. It's just some kind of conditioning that people have undergone with the passage of time. And when you actually examine it objectively, then you can say that's something that doesn't have any basis. And we should simply ignore any, you know, false feelings in that direction.
Right. Very good. Father Tad Boholcik is our guest today. Our topic, issues in bioethics. We have some callers lined up, Father, so we'll take a brief break, and then we will come back and hear from those callers with their questions on today's bioethics issues, issues in morality, issues in ethics having to do with biology and all the new technologies we have. 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live, and we'll be right back.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, my friends. This is Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers, and I'm challenging you to take the 20 Answers Challenge. Catholic Answers 20 Answers series offers clear arguments so anyone can master defending the fundamentals of our Catholic faith. They also arm the reader to converse intelligently about critical moral and cultural topics facing the church today, such as abortion, end-of-life issues, and the growth of Islam. Here's how the challenge works. When you purchase the complete set of all 20 books in the series, we will cut the price in half, and we're challenging you to read them all by the end of Lent. What a great preparation for Easter. But wait, there's more. Catholic Answers is going to take $10 from each set purchased and use it to provide materials to our good friends at St. Paul Street Evangelization so they can do what they do best, hit the streets, and share the Catholic faith. That's $10 from every set you purchase going to help our fellow workers in the vineyard. You win, St. Paul Street Evangelization wins, the Catholic Church wins. That's a win-win-win. Let's do something great for the kingdom. Call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com now to get your set and begin taking the 20 Answers Challenge today. In fact, why not buy two sets and challenge a friend to take the 20 Answers Challenge? That's 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teens spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Father Tad Poholchek, Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and if you have questions about any area of bioethics, please give us a call. Issues in bioethics is our topic, and we go to Cindy, listening in West Covina, California, on Immaculate Heart Radio. Cindy, your question for Father Tad.
Basically, my question is, how do you ethically and most Catholic way end life when someone has medical issues and they've found out that some organs don't function anymore?
Okay, Cindy, that's a good question. I think that people do encounter situations where death may be coming at them rather quickly as they undergo either one organ or sometimes multiple organ failure. When you ask, you know, what's the ethical way for our lives to end, we can certainly say right up front that we should never ourselves target our own lives through suicide. And, you know, that seems like a kind of obvious thing to say, but it's not that obvious because it's being debated now in many state legislatures. It's legal to ask your doctor in California, for example, to help you kill yourself. And in several other states, four or five other states, similar laws exist. So, you know, in terms of the eyes of God, we have a duty never to choose to target our own lives in that way, to commit suicide. Similarly, we should never ask anyone else to actively target our own lives. That would be what we call euthanasia. And if we end our lives in either of those two ways, you know, it's a unmitigated tragedy. It's a loss. It's a failure of the medical profession, and so on. So in terms of what's the ethical way, I mean, what you're really asking is, you know, does the Lord have a time anointed for our ending? And the answer is yes, He knows the death that each of us will undergo. It is a different death for each person. We all die in a slightly different way, and, you know, in a different time and through a different series of events. And I think an important piece of it is to be willing to say, you know, that I will accept whatever path the Lord chooses here, whatever disease comes my way, whatever maybe organ failure, whatever malady, you know, that the Lord in his wisdom, I will accept that and journey with him into death. And then a good death, you know, will involve a lot of elements. It will hopefully involve, as the time is progressing, making peace with other people around us, with family members, with loved ones, hopefully the last sacraments of the church, as people are getting ready to die, you know, as their disease is progressing more and more rapidly. I say that, and again, it seems like it should be obvious that we should call the priest, but I can tell you a lot of young people who I talk to, when their mom or their dad gets sick, they don't think about calling the priest. Their only thing that goes through their mind is, what's the next thing we can try medically? What's the next clinical trial maybe we could put mom or dad onto? And I think, you know, sometimes we have to step back, especially when we see the end approaching, and say, spiritually, what is it important to do here to get ready for death, you know, to meet the Lord? And so the sacraments are a really critical piece of that. And so, you know, I think that this, in the way of general counsel, would be some of the elements that are important. And also, you know, to remember that as we are dying, we are not required to use what are called heroic or extraordinary means, but we are required to use ordinary means. And this, the significance of this is that it means we have to assess. So if the doctor comes to us and says, well, you've got cancer, and what about this chemotherapy? Do you want to try it? We have to ask him, well, tell me about this chemo. You know, how bad are the side effects going to be? What is it going to do to me? What kinds of benefits can I expect from this chemo? And what kind of burdens? And then we weigh that. And if we say to ourselves, hey, the benefits are pretty high and the burdens are pretty small, then we would say, that's an ordinary treatment. And yes, I have to take care of myself. I probably should do that chemotherapy. But in other situations, after we've had those discussions with the medical team and with our other family members, we may realize, oh man, this chemotherapy has almost no chance of doing anything. And it's going to make me feel absolutely rotten, sick, vomiting, you know, other things. And therefore, I'm not going to do it because it's heroic. It's extraordinary, or to use the fancy word that we ethicists use, it's disproportionate. So knowing about that is, I think, very helpful and comforting to people who are dying, that we do not have to do absolutely everything. A lot of times Catholics get accused of that, and that's a complete misrepresentation of the church's teaching. It's false to say that we have to do everything. No, we have to do what is ordinary in taking care of ourselves and in taking responsibility for our own lives. So I hope that that's helpful, Cindy, you know, as some general pointers there.
Maybe I should clarify, the situation is he was comatose, had no oxygen for about 4 minutes, and has been having seizures, so they sedated. So he's unconscious, and they did a test and found out that 2 kidneys are not working. And I'm afraid there's going to be pressure from the doctors to let go. And how do we best prevent the family from doing that?
Okay, well, I mean, with those details, obviously details matter. So it's good that you, you know, introduce those, because the questions here are going to hinge on a couple of factors. One is, you know, is he in complete kidney failure and absolutely dependent on dialysis? And what is the nature of the other damage that was done, presumably to his brain during the time that that he was without oxygen? That, you know, is going to be important. And is there an ongoing dying process that's happening because of that oxygen deprivation? You know, is he in that process of dying, or is this something where he could be stabilized? And for example, if he had a kidney transplant, then he could, you know, continue to live for many years. there are details like this that you will have to discuss with the medical team to make sure that you fully understand them. And again, then make a determination about what is reasonable. Is dialysis reasonable for his case or not? Would something like a kidney transplant be worth considering or not? Why or why not? And to have those kinds of informed discussions, then it'll be possible to, you know, reach a conclusion that is reasonable. Because, you know, if he is in a very advanced state of dying, you know, he's had severe brain damage, and, you know, his brain is in the process of shutting down, and his kidneys are already gone, it probably would be heroic or disproportionate or extraordinary to think about something like a kidney transplant and maybe even dialysis. You know, it depends on how old he is. It depends on, you know, what else is going on. So I can't actually answer the medical specifics of your case. You've told me some of them, but this is the kind of thing where you and the family need to be in dialogue with your medical professionals, getting all this information, talking it through, and then asking yourself, all right, what they're offering to us here, is it reasonable, you know, whatever they end up offering as a possible treatment or not? And, you know, they may say to you, we really don't think that this is reasonable given his set of circumstances. And you'll have to, you know, parse that as well and think that through and determine, you know, how accurate that is. So these are the kinds of assessments that obviously someone like myself from a distance can't make. But you who are bedside, who are dealing with the medical team, you're in a much better position to be able to make those kinds of assessments.
Thank you, Cindy. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest today on Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Jordan in Sacramento, California, also listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Jordan, your question for Father Tad.
Hi, Father. I just had a question for you. Kind of a question with three facets to it. One is, you know, through my career, I work in the biotechnology area. And, you know, if you're working for a company that says engages in morally, ethically questionable practices, but you aren't specifically doing that work, is there an ethical problem with working for that company?
All right. Can you be a little more specific, maybe? Are there, you know, what types of problems are you thinking about in the company?
Like, there's a company I interviewed for once who I was going to be working in vaccine production, and the company also engaged in some, in some intrauterine or IVF type work, but my job specifically wasn't a part of it. Like, the company and its other sectors engaged in what would be some ethical issues or, you know, problems. But my work would be specifically, so like in a sense, in a case like that, would be working for a company be considered an ethical problem on like an applicant's part?
Okay, well, I understand the question, and good. It's a good question, Jordan, because this is actually a question that's very, very common today in the sense that there aren't a lot of companies that are, in a sense, totally without involvement in some kind of problematic connections. Maybe they have collaborations with other companies. Maybe they themselves are doing, let's say, human embryonic stem cell research using cell lines that have been approved by the NIH, or, you know, some other directions like you're mentioning in vitro fertilization. Maybe they make some reagents that are specific for doing in vitro fertilization. And, you know, you'd be concerned, am I supporting the company by working in another branch or another division of the company, even though I'm not doing any of that stuff myself, but I'm sort of indirectly supporting the company. And so part of the consideration is you have to assess how grave are the evils themselves that the company is participating in. And certainly as they become worse, then you have to try to distance yourself from that.
We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live with more from Father Tad Poholchik and your calls on questions having to do with bioethics and medical ethics. And wonderful calls so far. Thanks so much for them. 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll be right back.
Catholic Answers Live.
Hey everyone, this is Carlo Broussard. I've got a challenge for you. It's called the 20 Answers Challenge. Catholic Answers 20 Answers series offers hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world. Here's how the challenge works. When you purchase the sampler of all 20 books in the series, we're going to knock the price in half. And we're challenging you to finish them all this Lent and Easter season. Then, we're going to take $10 from each set purchase and provide materials to our friends at St. Paul Street Evangelization so they can do what they do best, hit the streets and share the Catholic faith. That's $10 from every set you purchase, going to help our fellow workers in the vineyard. You win, St. Paul Street Evangelization wins, the Catholic Church wins. That's a win-win-win. Together, we can be a part of something great. Call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com now to get your set and begin taking the 20 Answers Challenge today.
How can the Eucharist truly be Christ's body? Does belief in the real presence mean that Catholics are cannibals? Do the Bible and early Christians support Catholic teaching on the Eucharist? In 20 Answers, the Eucharist, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you deepen your own appreciation for this most precious sign of Christ's enduring presence in the world. 20 Answers, the Eucharist is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Take the 20 Answers Challenge for the month of February when you purchase the sampler of all 20 books in the 20 Answers series. We're going to take half price off. It'll be half price. Well, that's how that works. If you take half price off, then what's left is half price. And we're challenging you to finish them all this Lent and Easter season. That gives you until June 4th. I'm going to be taking the challenge and maybe chronicling my efforts there on social media. The offer applies to both the print books and the ebooks. In addition, when you get the half off the whole collection of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, $10 from your purchase is going to St. Paul Street Evangelization so they can do what they do best, which is hit the streets and share the Catholic faith. That's $10 from every set you purchase going to help our fellow workers in the vineyard. Visit the 20 Answers section of the shop at Catholic.com or call 888-291-8000 to order your full set of the 20 Answers books for half off. Our guest this hour, Father Tad Poholchik, is helping us work through issues in bioethics. And we were, when we left, Father, we were, the question was from a gentleman who was asking about he worked for a company or had the potential to work for a company that was doing some what it was clearly unethical bioethics work. He wouldn't have been working in that area. He would have been doing biology work in another area. And so his question was, could he work? Could he, in good conscience, work for that company?
Yes, and so I thought it'd be good to just wrap up a little bit on that question, because there are going to be circumstances where you may be convinced in the work that you are doing that you may be making a kind of material contribution that is fairly significant to the evil that is being done in another part of the company. And, you know, the question here becomes a causal question. How causally connected is my work to the evil that's happening in the other part of the company? And as that distance gets smaller and you realize, gee, you know, maybe I'm working as an accountant in this company, but I'm convinced that the accounting work that I'm doing is so important that if I didn't do it, it would sort of put the brakes on some of these evil activities that are going on there, then, you know, we would say as that distance shrinks between your activity and the evil activity, you have a stronger obligation to step away from that. So you know, that's a kind of general way of discussing what's called the principles of cooperation. We don't want to cooperate in evil in general, but sometimes our cooperation will be distant, quite distant, and we can tolerate some cooperation for a little while. So I'll just give you a simple example. There might be an abortion clinic in a town somewhere, small Midwest town, let's say, and there's a guy who they have called to trim the hedges out front. Now, you ask, well, when he's trimming those trimming the hedges, what's the causal connection between him doing that and the terrible deed of direct abortion that's happening inside the building? Well, there's almost no causal connection. So if this guy, you know, has no other work and he's got 8 kids and he's got to feed them and he's going to trim the hedges and earn some money to support his family, that's not going to raise a problem, you know, to do that temporarily. He should still, you know, try to distance himself from doing anything that's even remotely connected to the work of the abortion clinic. But if you're, for example, a nurse and you're working inside that abortion clinic, it gets much more difficult to actually be able to say that you can do that, especially, you know, if you're right there in the operating room and you're not doing the abortion, maybe the doctor is, but he says, flip on the vacuum machine. Well, you cannot. You are so close causally that you are providing what's called an essential circumstance for the commission of that grave evil. And you can't do it. You cannot flip on that switch. It would be immoral for you to actually do that. It would not be immoral for the guy to trim the hedges outside the building. So there are lines here that, you know, depend on that distance between what you're doing and what somebody else may be doing.
888-318-7884 is the number. This is Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholchik is taking your questions on issues in bioethics. We go to Julie in Sacramento, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Julie, your question for Father Tad.
Yes, hi. My question is on organ donation and donating your body to science. I want to help, but I'm wondering what the Catholic view is on this, if there's any specific scientific research that would be against or contrary to our faith. I just want to kind of know our view and help make the best election this way.
Julie, are you more interested in organ donation per se, meaning there's a couple of kinds of it. When you're alive, mm-hmm. you can donate, for example, one of your 2 kidneys to somebody who might need them, and you still have a kidney. Is that what you're asking about? Or are you asking about after you die that you would like to have your organs used?
I'm asking about more after we die.
Okay. Well, let me address that. In order to donate your organs after you die, certainly in general, this is something that the Church does allow for, and Pope John Paul II, in an important encyclical of his called Evangelium Vitae, which means on the gospel of life, he said it's actually a very generous act on the part of a person if they freely choose to donate their organs after they die. There's no moral obligation to do this, but it's something you could freely decide that you would like to do. It is important, of course, that the person have died before any unpaired organs are taken. I mentioned, you know, taking one of 2 kidneys. Those are paired organs. But now we're talking about the situation where you, you know, would have somebody maybe who at the end of life either just dies outright, meaning, you know, they die on the sidewalk and then they want to donate maybe corneas, or if they died quickly enough that they could retrieve an organ like the kidney, that would be fine. And then you have people who die in the hospital while they're on a ventilator. They undergo brain death, and those individuals will have organs that will still be receiving oxygen, and those organs may be able to be harvested, quite a few of them, in fact, for the benefit of other people once they have died. So those two situations are a little bit different, because when somebody sort of, you know, dies outright, collapses on the floor, you only have a very short window of opportunity to retrieve organs, because there is no oxygen getting to them, and those organs will go bad really quickly. Meanwhile, when you die on a ventilator from brain death, then those organs can be kind of partially preserved for a little bit longer, meaning, you know, a few days maybe. You'll have a longer window in which the donation can take place. So in either of those two cases, it would be morally permissible after somebody has died to donate those organs. And the last thing you asked about was donating your body to science. That also is permissible. I remember when I was a student many years ago at the University of Arizona, I took an anatomy and physiology course, and there was a woman, elderly woman, probably 75 or 80 years old, who had died. She donated her body to science, and as part of our anatomy and physiology class, you know, we were looking at different organs inside her body, and that was very helpful. You know, it was a part of my own formation in the medical sciences, and so you're free to do that as well. But it's important, if you do that, if you donate your body to science, you need to talk to the university and say, after you're done with my body, what's going to happen? You know, and many times what they will do is they will say, we'd be happy to provide for cremation and return the cremains to your family. And that's fine. But then the family needs to make sure that they make arrangements so that those ashes are properly interred, properly buried, and not, unfortunately, as so many people do today, scattered or, you know, put into jewelry or lockets or handed out among five or six different kids. None of that is respectful, you know, to our remains after we die. They should be placed into the earth so that people can come to a specific place and pray for us after we have departed from this world. So donating your body to science is, again, a generous act, and many people do choose to do that for the benefit of, for example, helping future physicians.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate the question. 888-318-7884 is the number. We're taking your questions about the moral implications of modern biotechnology. Maybe you have some uncertainty about a particular practice, a medical practice or a biotechnological practice. Father Tad Poholchik is here to take your questions. Again, that number, 888-31-TRUTH, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more questions for Father Tad Poholchik.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Hey everyone, this is Carlo Broussard. I've got a challenge for you. It's called the 20 Answers Challenge. Catholic Answers 20 Answers series offers hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world. Here's how the challenge works. When you purchase the sampler of all 20 books in the series, we're going to knock the price in half. And we're challenging you to finish them all this Lent and Easter season. Then, we're going to take $10 from each set purchase and provide materials to our friends at St. Paul Street Evangelization so they can do what they do best, hit the streets and share the Catholic faith. That's $10 from every set you purchase, going to help our fellow workers in the vineyard. You win, St. Paul Street Evangelization wins, the Catholic Church wins. That's a win-win-win. Together, we can be a part of something great. Call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com now to get your set and begin taking the 20 Answers Challenge today.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 6:14, King Herod, because of the guilt he felt for having put John the Baptist to death, was convinced that Jesus was really John and had come back to life. It is amazing how distorted one's view of life can become over the refusal to acknowledge former sinful and unrepented actions. The real tragedy here is that Jesus was the only answer to his plight and was so nearby. Yet Herod was so indisposed to recognize him. 3 years later, when Pilate sent Jesus to him during his passion, Herod actually met Jesus and treated him as if he were a fool. Still again, he failed to recognize the only one who could make him whole. The question remains, when do we fail to recognize him? The answer, basically every time we sin. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Father Tad Poholcik, a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. We're taking calls on issues in bioethics. I am Cy Kellett, your host. If you have a question in the area of bioethics, 888-318-7884 is the number. We go to Mario on Moody Air Force Base in Georgia, listening on the EWTN app. Mario, you are on with Father Tad Poholcik.
How's it going, gentlemen? How's it going, Father?
Great. Going well, Mario.
Yes. My question kind of deals with the issue of transgenderism and a conversation I had with a coworker of mine. His defense on transgenderism was, it kind of goes like this. If the functioning brain of that person works correctly, he looks in the mirror. If a man looks in the mirror, identifies, sees a man, but all the synapses in his brain come back out to where he responds, I should be a woman or I am a woman, and that shouldn't be correct. He was saying shouldn't that be evidence enough or reason enough to allow that person to go through sex change to go with the identity that the person is going through, since everything is correctly working in the thought process. Have you ever heard of this, or you've ever heard of someone trying to argue transgenderism through that way? And have you ever heard of any kind of research that supports that?
All right, great question, Mario. And I think that the way you framed it is becoming part of the cultural discourse around this. But, you know, the response here that I think it's important to clarify is that perceptions are not necessarily reality. Because somebody looks in the mirror and they see, one thing, and then within themselves they feel another, doesn't in and of itself. And you said, well, that they're correct in their thought processes. However, that's exactly where the debate resides, that in fact the thinking is not properly ordered, and internally there is not actually a proper order to their own self-understanding. It's similar to the case of, let's say you have a woman who's standing in front of you, and she says to you, and this woman, as you look at her, she is as thin as a pencil. You look at her and you think, if she gets any thinner, she's going to disappear into thin air. And she looks you straight in the eye and she says, I am as fat as an elephant. And so as a result of her belief about herself, she forces herself to vomit every time that she eats food. And that's why she, in fact, is as thin as she is. So, you know, she has this perception about who she is that does not, in fact, correspond to the reality of who she is. And we have a similar situation in the transgender equation, where we have individuals who are clearly of a defined chromosomal makeup, all right? And I want to just distinguish, because sometimes people think that all of this can be lumped together with intersex types of cases. And we're not talking about people who, for example, may be born with ambiguous genitalia, or people who have other problems of sexual development that are physiologically played out in their bodies. And, you know, they have things wrong with their bodies that are very, very clearly evident. This is instead, you know, people who have none of that, nothing wrong with the body, but they have this conviction that they really are meant to be the opposite sex. So that case is something analogous to that individual who's convinced that she is massively obese when, in fact, no such situation actually accrues. I have used an example that, you know, when I talk to high school students about this, that they have found to be helpful. And this is the example of coming across a fellow who says, you know, in my heart of hearts, in the innermost part of my being, I was born a pirate. I'm certain of it. No matter what you say, I know I was born a pirate. And so he goes to his doctor and he says, look, this is really who I am. Please cut off my hand and put on a hook. Now, if any doctor did that, he would be sued for malpractice so quickly and lose his license so immediately that it would make your head spin. However, when people come and say, well, I'm really the opposite sex, please cut off my genitalia, remarkably, the medical profession has caved here. And, you know, the studies that have been done in these cases where this has been done in large numbers indicates that these transgender individuals, when they are followed up long term, do not end up being happy. It doesn't solve the psychological problems that they have. There was a careful study that was done in Sweden, and they found that the rate of suicides among this population was about 20-fold higher than the general population. And, you know, here in the U.S., you could say, well, that's because the transgender people don't accept them and they might be discriminated against. But not in Sweden, let me tell you. In Sweden, this has been going on for decades. They've been doing this, and there's total social acceptance over there. And even with that, there is this incredibly high suicide rate among the transgender population. So there's a way in which the transgender individual is failing to accept themselves. They are actively rejecting who they are objectively. And this is a tragedy, and it really calls for good psychotherapy, not for interventions or mutilations of their bodies. That does not serve their best interests. So, you know, I think in that sense, that helps at least put a little bit of a framework around the type of question, Mario, that you received concerning transgender situations.
Father, could I say that the person that most of these people that are having this thought process are suffering from gender dysphoria?
Yes, or definitely. You could say that they are suffering from gender dysphoria, from a lack of clarity about their correct gender. And, you know, the reasons for this are probably very complicated. It's not, you know, entirely clear why people do have gender dysphoria of this kind. But, I mean, there are some perhaps factors in some cases. Sometimes it'll be related to how children were raised. Sometimes there may be, you know, issues of trauma. Sometimes there may be other factors that we don't know about that end up being very influential in affecting their own sense of self. And, you know, it really is a complicated thing, I believe, for any person to undergo sexual maturation in an ordered way. We live in a society where there's so many confusing signals, and we're getting more and more of them as time goes on, and young people are being subjected to those, you know, much more frequently. And I'm convinced that this kind of massive rise in these kinds of phenomena is related to a kind of breakdown more broadly in society about the proper understanding of human sexuality and what it means to sexually mature in a wholesome and correct way. We're tolerating many things that, you know, are now not good for men and women. And this is playing out, the consequences of this play out, because the arena of our sexuality is a very intimate, private arena, and a very delicate arena where you can do a lot of damage to people. So, you know, we have to be especially careful here not to give false answers to people when they have confusion in this area of their lives.
Mario, thank you so much for your question. We really appreciate it. This is Catholic Answers Live. Our issue today our issue today is any issue in bioethics. We go now to Donna in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Donna, your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Hi, Father Tad. Glad to be able to talk to you. I wanted to call, and my question has to do with vaccines and the use of aborted fetal cells in their manufacture. I am more than concerned, more than opposed to this, and I've done a bunch of research, especially the research that's been done by Catholic doctors and scientists such as Teresa Deischer at Sound Choice Pharmaceuticals, Children of Life for God, or Children of God for Life. There is much evidence that the aborted fetal cells that are used in particularly in the MMR and a few of the other vaccines, the chicken pox, that they can and probably do get into the DNA of our children and can, in fact, cause autism, the cancers,
All right, Donna, we're really limited with time. I think the question was very clear, and many people have this question. So sorry to interrupt you in the midst of the question, but I think that was enough to have a clear question. Father, how do you respond?
Yes. This is a complicated area. We only have 2 minutes, so I will just briefly say that some of the assertions, Donna, that I know you're convinced that you came to an accurate conclusion about them, but for example, the autism connection has been very, very carefully disproven. There have been very extended studies on that. So there are a number of areas here that have kind of taken on a folklorian character to them, and people repeat them, like this link with autism, which are not actually verified scientifically. The question of whether vaccines that were made in aborted fetal cell lines should be used, this question was posed to the Vatican a few years ago, and the take-home message was, if there are not other alternatives that were made in cell lines not from abortions, it is allowable for parents to use these vaccines, but when they do so, they should register their disapproval to the company that manufactured it and try to get an alternative formulation made up. Because if there's enough of a consumer outcry about this, then, of course, these companies will hear that and start responding. So I hope that's helpful, Donna.
Thank you very much, Donna. Thank you to all our callers today for your questions for Father Tad Poholchik. Father, there's no easy answers, but there are a few easy answers in this area, and you do a beautiful job of helping us work through the subtleties of these issues. I wonder, Father, could we have your blessing before we go?
I would be happy to. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. And you can find Father Tad Poholchik and more information on bioethics at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Please go by there and avail yourself of the many resources there. This is Catholic Answers Live. It's been a great week. Thanks so much for being with us this week on Catholic Answers Live. We will see you again next week.